Thank you, Debbie. And it is a pleasure to be here. And this is going to start out a little bit technical, but I promise you it won't, I won't labor that for you. Okay, but to give a little bit of background, and I'm also going to give my apologies because I think I know how to work this. Debbie gave me a 1 second talk on how to make it go. Yes, it does. Okay, so what we're going to try to talk about is arthritis, obviously. But we're not going to get into every little bit of arthritis because you can't do that in 20 or 30 minutes. I'm not going to talk about small joints. I'm not going to talk about your spine. I know you're going to have another talk about that soon. Hands are a very big part of arthritis and arthritis symptoms. But we can only do so much this morning. So we're going to talk about the big joints, and I'm going to show you some pictures of how it comes about. And we're going to talk about what causes the pain. Let me ask, can you guys see this? Would it be better if I stood over here? Is that better? And y'all can still see? Okay. So we're going to talk about what causes the pain, and that's where it's going to get a little bit technical for a short period of time. We'll talk about some of the risk factors, and we'll talk about what kind of treatment options there are. So what causes the pain in the joint? Okay, first of all, a synovial joint, let me see if I get this right, the synovium. The synovium is the lining of the joint, and almost every joint in your body is a synovial joint. Certainly the ones that move are synovial joints. The synovium is the lining, it produces the synovial fluid, and the synovial fluid is the stuff that's very slippery. It's the oil for the joints, if you will. The ligaments attach bone to bone, tendons attach muscle to bone. So the ligaments are important. They're important to keep your joints stable. They're important to keep them from moving in ways that would damage them. The articular cartilage, that's the white shiny stuff on the end of a chicken bone is what I say all the time. Because everybody, that's a visual for you guys and for me, but not for a lot of the young people. They have no idea what a chicken looks like, but they think it comes in a strip and fried. But and then the subchondral bone. Subchondral means below the cartilage. And the bone supporting the cartilage is a source of a problem if it starts to break down, because obviously if the foundation of your house starts to sink, so goes your house. Articular cartilage, the white shiny stuff, is compressively stiff. You squeeze it down, it squeezes back. And so it gives you that bit of shock absorbing that's important to keep your joints going. It's made up of hyaline cartilage. There's not a test at the end, but hyaline cartilage is the joint cartilage. It's the resilient, very specialized, and let me digress a second. Very specialized means that if you destroy it, it doesn't grow back. If you destroy a nerve, it doesn't grow back because it's very specialized tissue. But articular cartilage is usually where we think of as the first place that we see problems with arthritis. Okay, here's where it gets more and more technical for a couple of slides. The matrix. The matrix is the part of the cartilage that's made up of basically two things, two macromolecules, if you will. Type 2 collagen, and something called aggrecan. I don't want to delve into this too much, but aggrecan is a type of a macromolecule that has a very, very strong negative charge to it. Now, anybody that's got any chemistry going knows that water also has a negative charge. And you also know that like charges repel. So that's a good thing to keep it pushed apart and to give it that compressive stiffness. When these things start to go, that's where you have a problem. Chondrocytes, what are they? They're the cartilage cells. Now they do good things, and when they start getting arthritis, and let me apologize, your handout's not going to go exactly like the slides because I've rearranged and added a couple of things and taken some things out, but for the most part, it'll follow it. The matrix, cytokines and growth factors, you don't need to know about that other than just to hear it because it'll be important in a few minutes. But they also make enzymes that break down the matrix. So they make the matrix, but then when there's an inflammatory or a degenerative process, then they start to make things that start to break down the cartilage and break down the joint and so on and so forth. And we'll get to that in a minute as well. In arthritis, in osteoarthritis, and I probably should digress there, we're only talking about osteoarthritis. We're not talking about psoriatic arthritis, where you see the golfers advertising on that. We're not talking about rheumatoid arthritis. We're not talking about gouty arthritis. We're not talking about Reiter syndrome. We're talking about osteoarthritis. We are going to include post-traumatic arthritis. So if you break up your joint, we're going to lump that in because it acts the same way as typical osteoarthritis. There's something called interleukin beta, 1 beta, interleukin 1 beta, and tissue necrosis factor alpha, and that's these right here. Well, they decrease the collagen synthesis, which is a big part of this matrix up here. They also increase the proteases. Now, protease is something that is an enzyme that breaks down something, a protein, but it breaks down the cartilage and some of the matrix. And then finally, they increase the metabolic activity of the cartilage. Normally, your cartilage doesn't do much. Your cartilage does not, the hyaline cartilage or the articular cartilage, the cartilage on the end of the bone, really doesn't have much of a blood supply. It gets its nutrition from the joint fluid, which is made by the synovial cells, which are, make up all the lining of your joint. You gradually, in arthritis, there's a gradual depletion of this aggrecan that we talked about in the type 2 collagen, and it causes an unfurling. And interesting, I'm going to show you something in a minute, which is kind of a humorous thing, and it's something that's kind of easy to remember. But the point is it loses its compressive stiffness. So it no longer pushes back. You push down, it just pushes down. And then it starts to wear. And when it starts to wear, then you start getting disruptions in the matrix and in the cartilage. And then, guess what? That's like the pothole in the road out there. And this time of year, you see lots of potholes. And every time you get a crack in the pavement, and then it rains, and then it freezes, ice expands, makes the pothole bigger. But it's also a hydraulic, and that's important too. Hydraulics, fluid under pressure. Joint fluid, crack in the cartilage, walking. All of a sudden, you've got a hydraulic. And so you may hear people say that I've got cysts in my knees. Well, degenerative cysts are nothing more than a pothole in the road at rush hour. You get a pothole, it rains, thousands of cars run over it, they keep squishing the water down, keeps making the pothole bigger. Same thing happens in your knee. You walk, you get a little crack in the cartilage, starts breaking down, the joint fluid gets in the crack, you take a step, it squeezes it down. That's one car or one tire. Well, how many times do you take a step? If it hurts, not so many. But if it's not so bad, or initially, you walk on it, and then it just perpetuates. All right, that's all, okay? Everybody relaxed. We're all off the cytokines and the enzymes and the breakdown and so on and so forth. Osteoarthritis is really not considered an inflammatory arthritis. And part of that is because you don't see a lot of inflammatory cells in the tissue fluid. But it does have inflammation, and that's a big component of what happens. Most of it, though, is confined to that cartilage around the ends of the bone, and then it sets up this so-called cytokine storm, which causes these cyclooxygenases, which are, again, enzymes, and these, let me just say, multiple enzymes to upregulate or to start increasing. Now, if you've kept up with the direct patient marketing on Vioxx, Bextra, and Celebrex, those are COX-2-specific prostaglandin inhibitors. So here comes the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, because these things kind of metabolize the cartilage. But I'm going to tell you about that in just a second as well. There are no blood markers to date that we can take a blood test and say, yes, you have osteoarthritis. There may be some opportunity in the future for some of these things to be able to be a marker. I'm not sure it changes anything. I mean, it doesn't make your arthritis any better. So let's talk just a minute about some risk factors, because then you're starting to wonder, well, why do I get this? Am I at risk? What can I do to prevent it? Genetics do play a role, and they probably play more of a role than we think. Certainly osteoarthritis of the knees and the hips are definitely, there's an association with genetics. People whose parents have them and so on, you're much more likely to have it. And then I like this part. They call this the frizz gene because it codes for the frizzle protein. And I like to just assume that it becomes frazzled because that's kind of what's going on. It unfurls, it starts to break down, and it doesn't work quite right. And if you're set up for that through your genes, which you can't control, then you know, you're at risk to develop arthritis. Trauma. This is the post-traumatic arthritis. That's something everybody's familiar with, and it has to do with your experiences. If you tear your ACL, if you tear your meniscus, your cartilage, and I'm going to show some pictures of that in a second, then you're at risk to develop arthritis. And this Framingham study, and if anybody's interested in references, I didn't put them in here, but you're welcome to them, and I'll be happy to get them for you. This Framingham study talks about men that had a history of a major knee surgery. Now, that includes things like your ACL reconstruction, whether you broke your knee joint. It doesn't really account for a torn cartilage removal or something like that. A major knee surgery. That's a normal meniscus. When people say they tore their cartilage, that's the cartilage they're talking about. And this is up here. This is the femur above, this is the tibia below, so you're looking into the joint, and that's the meniscus right there. And the next slide is a tear, and that's a probe. And just to give you some sort of scale, the distance between these lines is a millimeter. Now, I apologize, the girls in the office, then these x-rays are my x-rays, but you don't have any names on them, but I don't think any of you guys are on any of these x-rays. So I tried to make sure of that. This one has a knee immobilizer on it. That's these three metal strips right here. But if you look carefully, you can see right here, this guy fell from a trailer and he's broken his knee into the joint. I'll show you this next one. You might can see it a little bit better. You see how it's here? You can see that fracture line, but it's also split up here. Now, he's at risk to develop post-traumatic arthritis. He's about, I don't know, 40, maybe 45. And so we fixed it. We tried to restore the joint up here so that there's not a step off. But again, once you break into the joint, you're at risk. That's the lateral, that's the other view. Doing something like that. Anybody familiar with J.H. Ranch? It's a camp in California. It's an awesome experience, but my daughter and I went there this summer and I was surprised to see that this is the lake. Now, you gotta know too, the water's about 60 degrees. So it's not just going off that ramp on a bicycle and hitting the water. It's really cold, too. And I'll show you in the second, we'll see a different way. But you could see how that could potentially put you at risk for post-traumatic arthritis, right? I mean, there's all sorts of opportunities there. Speaking of which, oops. Let's see if I can. I may have to do something. Let me see if we can make the, there we go. Watch carefully, right about there. If it's going, it doesn't look like it's going. Oh, it says it's not available. Oh well. All right, well, I will tell you, that right there is the ramp next to the other one. It's that ramp. And when you go off of that one, you turn a backflip. And I had a video. I'm sorry it didn't come out. But so you'll watch this guy come down this hill right here and go off and turn a flip, except he does a face plant on the bicycle. And I'm thinking, okay. Anyway. Other risk factors. Are you heavy? BMI, body mass index. Generally thinking more than 25 to 28 is considered obese, for whatever that is worth. Now that's based on the insurance schedules, but it is a relative risk because the heavier you are, the more weight, the more stress you put on your joints. Heavier people tend to have more severe symptoms for the same reason. The more you load it, you put about 2 times your body weight when you walk. You put about 6 times your body weight on your knee or your leg when you run. It's more likely to progress the heavier you are. Again, the more stress you're putting on the joint, the more weight you're putting on it. It's more so for your knees than for your hips. Heavier people tend to have more problems with their knees. Now, if you're heavy, it doesn't mean you get arthritis. If you're thin, it doesn't mean you don't get arthritis. So it's a relative risk. Unfortunately, ladies, it's more of a linear relationship with you. The heavier you are, the more likely you are to have arthritis symptoms. But the good news is that it tends to decrease your symptoms if you can get some weight off. And it doesn't have to be. If you're 100 pounds overweight, losing 90 pounds is not what's necessary before you get some relief of your symptoms. It might be 10 or 15 pounds, which I understand. I mean, it's not easy. If it was, we'd all look like the models or whatever. No, because we're not going to Photoshop ourselves. But okay, the other thing, women tend to show more arthritis than men, which is a little contrary. That men tend to have more injuries, and so they tend to get more post-traumatic arthritis. Women tend to have more arthritis symptoms in their hands than men. And the repetitive injury, you can talk about minors. I didn't put it on here because it's really spine. Truck drivers, the vibration and the bouncing in the seats tend to get their backs in trouble. Tend to be more hip arthritis findings in farmers. And runners, there may show some increased risk of hip and knee arthritis in professional runners. Now that's not, I mean, these are the guys that are running marathons and triathlons and getting paid for it, so they're doing it all the time. And then proprioception, patients with decreased proprioception. That's where am I in space? That's where is my foot in space? That's where is my knee in space? In other words, if you can't tell where your knee is because your nerves don't work very well, then you're more likely to injure it. Diabetics are the classic case of that. And that's why you see more foot problems, more foot lesions, more foot sores, and so on in diabetics, because they don't feel their feet quite as well most of the time. And so when you get into that peripheral neuropathy, then you just keep, if you've got normal feeling and something hurts, you either change the way you walk, change your shoes, or just stay off of it until it gets better. But if you can't feel it, then you just keep repetitively rubbing it or irritating it. Okay, age, I like to think of it as experience rather than age, because of this, right? Oops, sorry. Did I go back too far? Let's go back one. There we go. Osteoarthritis is not an inevitable consequence of getting older. And it's not simply just wearing out of your joints. But the more experience you have, if you were an athlete and got hurt several times, you're probably more likely to develop degenerative changes. To what degree, it just depends. You know, if you have a car wreck, if you have a fall, if you have some other injury, if you have chemotherapy, you can develop something called avascular necrosis of your hips, or radiation. There are lots of things, but that's experience. It doesn't matter if you're 20 or you're 80. It's what the experience you had that helps determine that. I think that's the most important. The cartilages do become less responsive to loading as we get older. All of our tissues wear out, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you get arthritis. But your disc spaces, most of your tissues lose their water content to some extent, which can attribute to why people get a little bit shorter. We stand more as adults. And so the compressive force is there. But the cartilage, loses some of its responsiveness to loading. So whereas before it bounced, it went down and bounced back like a ball, now it's more like florist foam that you stick flowers in. You know, the green stuff you put your finger in and it doesn't come back. Your cartilage tends to, as we get older, it wants to do that more and more. As a rule, muscles get weaker. We're not as active. Ligaments get stiffer. So we've got less compressive response to loading, we've got weaker muscles, and we've got stiffer ligaments. So now all of a sudden we're a setup for some kind of a problem with a joint. And that's wherein lies the encouragement to stay active. Keep your muscles going, keep them loose, keep mobility in place. God made joints to move, and if you don't move them, they get stiff. Bone density, that's always a question. Interestingly enough, the harder your bones are, the more likely you are to get arthritis. And that's wherein lies this negative association with arthritis. Do you remember me commenting on subchondral bone, the bone that sits below the cartilage in your joint, and the stuff that supports the joint cartilage? If that's compliant, if that's a little softer, like it would be in osteoporosis, then it gives a little bit more. So it may not give you that injury. Think about it like this. If you jump off of a step or two and land on the grass, it's not nearly as uncomfortable as if you jump off a step or two and land on the concrete floor. So if you've got a lot of bone density, if your bones are very dense like concrete, then you have a little bit more risk for osteoarthritis. Osteoporosis is the grass. Now, those are not 100%. Okay, just because you've got osteoporosis doesn't mean you won't get arthritis, and just because you have really strong, hard bones doesn't mean you're going to get it. Let me back up a second. If you have osteoporosis, it doesn't mean that you're spared from arthritis, because plenty of people with osteoporosis have arthritis. Just as much, if you are on your feet and you're stable and you're doing weight-bearing exercises and you're taking vitamin D and calcium and you're getting in the sun and all the sort of things that we tell folks to do, doesn't mean that you're going to get arthritis, but that there's a correlation. Anatomy. If you have, the classic example here is for the larger joints are hip dysplasia in kids, people that had a hip dislocation when they were born, scoliosis in your back. It wears differently. It's not set up the way God should have, or the way they were designed to set up. Something went wrong. You've got an abnormal wearing. I'm going to just show you a couple of pictures of that in a minute. X-rays are still the gold standard for arthritis. You look for bone spurs. You look for joint space narrowing. MRIs, they can be important. They're terrible to assess your arthritis. They just don't, unless you're missing the whole cartilage spot on the end of the bone, or you've got some type of a compression fracture where it shows some bruising behind it, they're not very good. They'll tell you the cartilage is thinning, but we're several years away from having really good MRIs to talk about arthritis. And then I said earlier, right now there's no blood test. There is for rheumatoid arthritis, there is for lupus, there's not for osteoarthritis. So what are our goals in our treatment? And then we're going to go through some of the treatment in a minute. Well, number one is pain relief. Everybody in here has taken an Advil, an aspirin, a Tylenol, or something like that for pain. Now, it wasn't because you thought it was going to fix your arthritis or fix your sore back or whatever. It was really the pain. And that's really a big goal in treatment of arthritis. We want to improve physical function. The idea is that if your knee is sore, and I can't tell you the number of times I hear this on a daily basis, I can't exercise, so I can't get the weight off, and that's why my knee hurts and is arthritic. Sort of. But staying active improves everything. Yes, it can help you burn more calories, but it makes you feel better about yourself. If you feel better about yourself and you're able to get out and do something and you've got something to look forward to, you'll tolerate a little discomfort a lot better. It's when pain becomes 24/7 that it's tough. It's tough to deal with. Unfortunately, unlike many, many other disease processes, we don't have a medicine that really treats, or I said, a disease-modifying drug. It doesn't really treat the arthritis. They treat the symptoms. They treat the pain. They might improve your function, but they don't go back and fix what's already gone. So our treatments, if we drill down a little bit more, we go to non-surgical treatments. Physical therapy, obvious things there. Improve your mobility, improve your muscle strength, loosen your joints up. Bracing and heel wedges. Bracing can be very helpful, especially in knees. Not so good in hips. Pretty well, they work pretty well in ankles. Heel wedges, the idea there is that if you've got a worn out inside part of your knee and you put a lateral or an outside heel wedge, the first thing to hit is the outside of your foot. So when you step, it forces you to put more weight on the outside because it pushes you this way. Does that make sense? If it's the outside, you can put them on the inside so that the inside hits and you basically unload that affected compartment of your knee joint. Sometimes they work great, sometimes they don't work very well, but they're inexpensive and they're easy. You can put them in any shoes. There are no consequences to that. I will say you need to wear them in both sides, because if you don't, you're going to be off balance, and then there's all sorts of opportunities for problems there. Injections. Everybody knows about injections. Get a shot, it works. Steroids help. They help because, as we talked about earlier, the cells in your knee start putting out these enzymes that cause more problems. And the way the steroids work is they stabilize the membranes and don't let those enzymes get released into your knee joint. They don't fix it. They just help settle down some of the inflammation. Most people know the visco supplements as either the rooster shot, the chicken shot, the gel shots. I dare say few of you know them as visco supplements or hyaluronic acid derivatives, but that's really what they are. And they can be helpful. There's a lot of work now, a lot of research done, and a lot of papers put out that are conflicting about this. Do they really help? Do they really change your outcome? Do they really improve your symptoms? Some say they don't make any difference. Some say they help. The good news is I've seen none that say that they hurt. So if they help, and it's only yours, and you're one in a million, if it's yours, it's 100% in your series. So because they don't hurt, and I'm saying hurt, yeah, it is a needle stick, but they don't hurt your knee. They don't cause any long-term problems with it. I use them a lot, and most people get very good relief from them. And there are five different brands. Most people don't use Hyalgen. It was the first one out. Most people use OrthoViscuFlex or Syndis. Some people still use Suparts. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, Advil, Aleve, Motrin, aspirin falls in that category. Celebrex, all of those things work to inhibit the prostaglandins. Don't worry about it, but that's where they work. And that's part of this cyclooxygenase is a prostaglandin. It's a path or a part of the pathway where that breaks down. And then the nutraceuticals. What are nutraceuticals? Are they medical foods? Okay, some people like to say that. That's where the nutrition part of it, and the nutraceuticals, pharmaceuticals, medications are something you would take as a food source. But glucosamine and chondroitin, Osteobiflex, Cosamine DS, Joint Juice, Move Free, you can buy them anywhere. You can buy single, double, triple strength. You can buy gels, capsules, liquids. I mean, they're all over the place for a lot of reasons. Number one, for the people they help, they are wonderful. And there are some people here that have great relief by taking glucosamine and chondroitin. Again, as far as we know, it doesn't hurt. The only thing I've heard about that is I had a lady that had high blood pressure who felt like she was retaining fluid because of the sodium content in the glucosamine. And that was just several months ago. And I've been recommending that for years. So, and she's the only person I've heard of. And then Limbrel, it's the only medical, it's the only prescription nutraceutical that I'm aware of. And it works reasonably well. It's not generic, so it's very expensive. But it can be helpful, especially in somebody that's taking Plavix, or Plavix and Coumadin, or warfarin sodium, which is blood thinners. It doesn't interact with those. It doesn't give you the black box warning that the anti-inflammatories give you for cardiovascular effects. And then surgical, arthroscopy. Sometimes arthroscopy is not the way to go because you go fooling around in somebody's knee that's already arthritic and all you wind up with an arthritic sore knee. Now, a lot of times you don't know. You don't know going in. The x-rays look fine. The MRI shows a torn cartilage. Their exam is a torn cartilage. You look in their knee and you go, uh-oh, this is not happy. Most of those people still get better. But you know, knowing somebody has a bunch of arthritis is not the time to start thinking about arthroscopy. Maybe with an exception of your hip, and I'm not going to get into that too much. There's something called femoral acetabular impingement where you kind of hit, the ball kind of hits on the side. And people are going in arthroscopically and shaving that off. I think the jury's still out. That hadn't been done but for a couple, 3 years. So long term, it may or may not be a good thing. And then arthroplasty, that's your total joint replacement. We're going to talk a lot about that in a second. And then arthrodesis, that's a fusion. That's making the two bones grow together. And that'll stop the pain because arthritic pain is usually secondary to small amounts of motion. It's not normal motion. It's a rough spot, and usually as it starts moving less and less, it hurts more and more. And arthrodesis, very good in your ankle and your foot because the joint replacements are not very good down there. Knees, a stiff knee is a challenge on a lot of different fronts. Stiff hip is a very big functional problem. Sitting in a chair, getting in the car, just walking, you wind up making your back very sore. So that's not the primary goals. Total joint replacement is clearly the single most effective. And good news is the failure rate's about 1% per year. That's pretty good. The better outcomes in people that are over 50, probably because you got more sense. Now that I'm 50, I can say that. But you're a little more reasonable. You put joints in young people and they think, wow, my knee doesn't hurt, my hip doesn't hurt, I'm going at it, and they do. And you certainly have some consequences from that if you overdo it. It's better if you don't wait until you're absolutely debilitated. Total knee replacement, the best indicator of post-operative range of motion is pre-operative range of motion. If you're stiff going in, you've got to work to not be stiff coming out. And then stem cells. And somebody's going to ask me about stem cells probably. Interestingly enough, there's some guys in there, multiple different centers. I've heard the fellow speak that's in Scottsdale, Arizona, and they're working on it pretty hard. And they have gotten to the point where they can make, you ready for this? Your fat cells turn into cartilage. Now, the problem is how do you get them in there where you need them? And it looks like hyaline cartilage. It looks like joint cartilage. But how do you get it there and how do you get it to stay? And we don't really know. They're working on that. That's been several years ago since I heard him speak, and I watch that fairly regularly. Nobody's got the answer yet. But at some point, somebody will come up with a way that will probably work. But it's probably not in our lifetime. I hope it is, but I'm not sure it will be. Okay, now we're going to, very briefly, and I brought some examples, and I'll show you some of these in a minute. Bearing surfaces. You've probably heard a lot about metal on metal. That was very popular about 40 years ago, and it was very popular about 10 years ago. It's not popular at all now because of the metal ions and all the stuff that can go along with that. And I don't want to talk about that too much. So most people are not doing metal. Some of these resurfacing hips, which actually there's one called the Birmingham hip, not because of Birmingham, Alabama, because of Birmingham, England, because that's where the gentleman sort of championed it and designed it. There's still some people putting those in. Metal poly is polyethylene or high molecular weight, highly cross-linked polyethylene, which is basically plastic that holds up well under wear. That's the standard. I think that's the gold standard. We go away from it. We go to metal, we go to ceramic on the poly, we go to ceramic on ceramic. It still comes back. That's still where everybody, that's the default mode. Now, and I'm gonna show you this in a minute too. There's a new, and I say new, it's been out probably 10 years, called Oxinium. And Oxinium on plastic or poly is probably the thing to go, and that's what I'm using now. And that's the one, that's the only joint that I'm aware of the FDA has ever said it is good for this many, many years, and they're saying it's the 30-year knee. It is a ceramicized metal. So, and there, the company's propaganda says it's 4,900 times more resistant to wear than cobalt chrome, which is the normal metal. That's pretty good. The point is that your ceramic coffee cup is much slipperier than your metal pot. That's the best analogy I can tell you. It really, the water runs off of it. It's wettable. The water runs over it. So the ceramics can be brittle, just like your coffee cup. This is a ceramicized metal. And I'd say, if you're interested, look that up, because there's a lot of information about it, and it's really pretty interesting. Then you can talk about total knee, partial knee. The CR is cruciate retaining or posterior stabilized. That just depends on which ligaments do you cut, your anterior cruciate and your posterior cruciate. That's a posterior stabilized, or just the anterior cruciate. And then mobile bearing. There are knees where the plastic moves inside the metal. And some people feel like those are the greatest. Some people don't like them at all. Classic history or a classic example of bad knees. No, this is not somebody in this room. This happens to be more in the outside or lateral compartment, and unfortunately it's both sides, and this poor lady has had a terrible time walking. I don't know that you'd treat that non-surgically. There's not a lot you can do for that. Let me get back to that one just a second. The concern when your knee is not kneed, if you will, or valgus, is that if it gets too badly, the nerve that runs right around here, when you straighten it up to fix it, you can stretch that nerve and wind up with a foot drop. So that's one where it took me a while to encourage her to do something before she had problems with that. Normal looking knee x-rays, so you can kind of compare that to that. We're going to come back to that arthritic knee in a second. Just a different one. This is just kind of what an x-ray, and these little things here are the staples. This is an immediate post-op, and good. I was like, oh, did I have the name on there? But I didn't. I cut that off. And you can see they have some arthritis on the other knee as well. You can see the bone spurs here. You can see the joint space narrowing compared to this one, although the outside compartment or lateral compartment is involved to some extent. There's that lady's knees again. Really lost the space. Even on this inside that doesn't look like it's so involved, I would submit that that's got a cavity there or a concave point. You can look right there, that's probably a cyst. Then we jump on to hips. You can do a total hip, that just means you fix the cup and the ball. You can do a hemiarthroplasty, which is just the ball. And we do that a lot for hip fractures because it's not as involved. And most of the time with a hip fracture, you want to try to get in and get out and let them get up and get going. I'll go back to that for a second on the knees. Now let's just keep going. Arthroscopy of the hip, we talked about that a little bit. Relatively new technique. I say new, it's been around for a long time, but it's becoming more and more popular. And then you probably hear a lot on hips about anterior versus posterior approach. Well, you do it anterior and it's a muscle splitting. Well, that's true. Or you do a posterior approach and it's more involved. Well, maybe a little bit. There are no studies that show that one approach is better, safer, or you have fewer complications than the other. The anterior approach, not as many people use them because there are certain things that don't allow you to do an anterior approach. If you're real heavy, if you're real tall, you have to have a special table, you have to use the x-ray. There's an increased risk of breaking things because of the positions you have to put the patient in. So most people still fall back to the posterior approach. It's a good proven approach that most people do extremely well with. And the head size, which I'll mention next, makes a lot of difference. Used to, and you may know some people that have had their total hip dislocate. That was much, much, much more common when we used 28 millimeter heads instead of what we use now, which are usually 36 or 40 or even 44 millimeter heads. Significantly larger gives you more of an anatomic total hip replacement. It gives you more motion and more stability. And then I just touched on the dislocation part. So normal hip x-ray, arthritis, some here, oops, this is the old one. Okay, so developmental dysplasia, this is what I was talking about earlier. If you look at this hip, that's pretty normal. If you look at this one, see how it's really high and it's really kind of worn its own socket up here called a false acetabulum. So you bring this down, try to put it back in the same spot. You just leave all this up here and try. That's an anatomy risk factor for arthritis. All right, total shoulders, and we're almost finished. Total shoulders, partial shoulder, or reverse shoulder. Total shoulder is just like the hip. You do the ball and you do the cup. A lot of people don't do the cup part. It's called the glenoid because it's a challenge. It's tough, especially in larger people. It's a deep place. It's hard to get exposure. It does give you more pain relief, especially if you have arthritis there. If you don't have a lot of arthritis, and I did two hemi shoulders yesterday on people that are young but had terrible arthritis on the ball part, but the cup part was reasonably well preserved. You also put them at risk to how much you can lift. You really ought to not lift more than 30 or 40 pounds with your affected shoulder with a total shoulder. Hemi or a partial shoulder probably doesn't matter. And then the reverse shoulder. Reverse shoulders are a fairly new treatment, and reverse doesn't mean we put it in backwards. It does mean that you put the ball on the cup and the cup on the ball. And the point is, and I think I got a slide of that, normal shoulder x-ray, arthritic shoulder x-ray. This is one of the guys that I did yesterday. See that big spur right there? But this is pretty well maintained. Now, we go in there and we look at that and make sure, but his was reasonably well preserved. And I think he's 39. And this is a total shoulder. This is a different patient, but total shoulder. You can see this little button right here. That's just so you can see, because this is a plastic cup in here. The reverse shoulder, you put the cup on the ball and the ball on the cup. And the point there is that if you've got a rotator cuff tear that cannot be fixed, you can't raise your arm very well. Some people do it, and that's a totally different topic, but if you can put this here, you can use your deltoid, which is the big muscle you can feel. You can power your shoulder. If you don't, if the rotator cuff attaches, if the rotator cuff attaches here, and the bone is the acromion up on the top, which is the bone you can feel on the top of your shoulder. If you don't have the rotator cuff, then your deltoid muscle, which attaches out here, just pulls it up. So it bumps under the bottom of the acromion if you don't have a rotator cuff. But if you put the cup here and you put the ball here, now where your deltoid muscle attaches here will pull you up and you have a functional shoulder. Plus, a lot of people that have bad arthritis or bad rotator cuff tears that have been there a long time and have already got pretty significant arthritis. And so this has been a really good thing. It's not a panacea. It's not for everybody. Although some people want to do that, that's not the go-to for everything. That's what one looks like on a reverse. That's what the x-ray looks like. And then finally, we're going to do elbows very briefly, normal elbow x-ray. And yes, you can do elbow replacements, and they work pretty well. That's what an elbow replacement looks like. This is a lady that had broken her elbow years ago and had done fairly well and actually had very good motion until about, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 months ago. And we injected her a few times, and it just kept getting worse to the point where she wasn't sleeping. And so, let's see, I thought I had her, I guess we missed it. We'll get you the other disc for the DVD. But the X-rays, this was her joint here is pretty destroyed, and you basically come in and this is a more of a fixed bearing as opposed to your knees and your hips. This is connected together, and then that's the radial head, but you really just leave it alone. And she is extremely happy with this because she's had all this pain. She already had motion, good motion, so she probably lacks about maybe 10 degrees of full extension and has excellent flexion. So, summary. Pain, we talked about what you can do for it, what causes it. We talked about the risk factors, we talked about some treatments, and then the future, and that's the stem cell thing that we were talking about. That's new joint replacements. It's how do you do them? Do you do them MRI designed? Sure, you can. Nobody's doing a lot of the robotic stuff because the setup is so labor intensive. And if you don't get your setup just right, it's not like taking out your gallbladder or doing a prostatectomy or doing a hysterectomy with the robot. You've probably heard of the Da Vinci's. That's a different game. Because everybody's deformities are different in their knees and hips. So nobody's really jumped on that. We have started doing some MRI guided. You put the same joint in, they just do an MRI and make your cutting blocks so that they're a little bit more precise. But in my experience, I don't know that they do any better than using the standard cutting guides. And that just raises the cost because somebody's got to pay for the MRI. So in a minute, we're going to do questions, but I want to leave you with a quote, which I love. It's very appropriate for the operating room, and I'll let you read it for a second, but it goes, and the interesting thing is who made the statement. It's, we the unwilling, led by the unknowing, are doing the impossible for the ungrateful. We've done so much for so long with so little, we're now qualified to do anything with nothing. And when things start going bad, and we don't have this, or we'll have to get this. And then I just, after a couple of times, I just pull that quote out, and here we go. So at this point, thank you for having me. I enjoy doing this, and we'll open it up for questions.